Chapter 12. This time the trail was easier. It was better packed, and they were not carrying mail against time. The day's run was shorter, and likewise the hours on trail. On his mail run, Daylight had played out 3 Indians, but his present partners knew that they must not be played out when they arrived at the Stewart bars, so they set the slower pace. And under this milder toil, where his companions nevertheless grew weary, Daylight recuperated and rested up. At 40 mile they laid over 2 days for the sake of the dogs, and at 60 mile Daylight's team was left with the trader. Unlike Daylight, after the terrible run from Selkirk to Circle City, they had been unable to recuperate on the back trail. So the 4 men pulled on from 60 mile with a fresh team of dogs on Daylight's sled. The following night they camped in the cluster of islands at the mouth of the Stewart. Daylight talked town sights, and, though the others laughed at him, he staked the whole maze of high, wooded islands. Just supposing the big strike does come on the Stewart, he argued. Maybe you all will be in on it, and then again maybe you all won't. But I sure will. You all had better reconsider and go in with me on it. But they were stubborn. You're as bad as Harper and Joe Laju, said Joe Hines. They're always at that game. You know that big flat just below the Klondike, and under Moosehide Mountain? Well, the recorder at 40 Mile was telling me they staked that not a month ago the Harper and Laju town site. Ha! 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 Elijah and Finn joined him in his laughter, but Daylight was gravely in earnest. There she is, he cried. He hunch is working. It's in the air, I tell you all. What did they all stake the big flat for, if they all didn't get the hunch? Wish I'd staked it. The regret in his voice was provocative of a second burst of laughter. Laugh, you all, laugh. That's what's the trouble with you all. You all think gold hunting is the only way to make a stake. But let me tell you all that, when the big strike sure does come, you all will do a little surface scratching and muck raking, but danged little you all will have to show for it. You all laugh at quicksilver in the riffles, and think flour gold was manufactured by God Almighty for the express purpose of fooling suckers and chichaquos. Nothing but coarse gold for you all, that's your way, not getting half of it out of the ground, and losing into the tailings half of what you all do get. But the men that land big will be them that stake the town sites, organize the trading companies, start the banks, hear the explosion of mirth drowned them out. Banks in Alaska. The idea of it was excruciating. Yep, and start the stock exchanges dash, again they were convulsed. Joe Hines rolled over on his sleeping robe, holding his sides. And after them will come the big mining sharks, that buy whole creeks, where you all have been scratching like a lot of picayune hens, and they all will go to hydraulicking in summer and steam thawing in winter, steam thawing. That was the limit. Daylight was certainly exceeding himself in his consummate fun-making. Steam thawing when even wood-burning was an untried experiment, a dream in the air. Laugh, dang you, laugh. Why your eyes ain't open yet. You all are a bunch of little mewing kittens. I tell you all, if that strike comes on Klondike, Harper, and Laju will be millionaires. And if it comes on Stewart, you all watch the Elam Harnish town site boom. In them days, when you all come around making poor mouths. Dot, he heaved a sigh of resignation. I suppose I'll have to give you all a grub steak or soup, or something or other. Daylight had vision. His scope had been rigidly limited, yet whatever he saw big. His mind was orderly, his imagination practical, and he never dreamed idly. When he superimposed a feverish metropolis on a waste of timbered, snow-covered flat, he predicated first the gold strike that made the city possible, and next he had an eye for steamboat landings, sawmill and warehouse locations, and all the needs of a far northern mining city. But this, in turn, was the mere setting for something bigger, namely, the play of temperament. Opportunities swarmed in the streets and buildings, and human and economic relations of the city of his dream. It was a larger table for gambling. The limit was the sky, with the Southland on one side, and the Aurora Borealis on the other. The play would be big, bigger than any Yukoner had ever imagined, and he, Burning Daylight, would see that he got in on that play. In the meantime, there was naught to show for it but the hunch. But it was coming. As he would stake his last ounce on a good poker hand, so he staked his life and effort on the hunch that the future held in store a big strike on the upper river. So he and his three companions, with dogs, and sleds, and snowshoes, toiled up the frozen breast of the Stewart, toiled on and on through the white wilderness, where the unending stillness was never broken by the voices of men, the stroke of an axe, or the distant crack of a rifle. They alone moved through the vast and frozen quiet, little mites of earthmen, crawling their score of miles a day, melting the ice, that they might have water to drink, camping in the snow at night, their wolf dogs curled in frost-rimed, hairy bunches, their eight snowshoes stuck on end in the snow beside the sleds. No signs of other men did they see, though once they passed a rude poling boat, cached on a platform by the river bank. Whoever had cached it had never come back for it, and they wondered and mushed on. Another time they chanced upon the site of an Indian village, but the Indians had disappeared. Undoubtedly they were on the higher reaches of the Stewart in pursuit of the moose herds. 200 miles up from the Yukon, they came upon what Elijah decided were the bars mentioned by Al Mayo. A permanent camp was made, their outfit of food cached on the high platform to keep it from the dogs, and they started work on the bars, cutting their way down to gravel through the rim of ice. It was a hard and simple life. Breakfast over, and they were at work by the first gray light, and when night descended, they did their cooking and camp chores, smoked and yarned for a while, then rolled up in their sleeping robes, and slept while the Aurora Borealis flamed overhead, and the stars leaped and danced in the great cold. Their fare was monotonous. Sourdough bread, bacon, beans, and an occasional dish of rice cooked along with a handful of prunes. Fresh meat they failed to obtain. There was an unwonted absence of animal life. At rare intervals they chanced upon the trail of a snowshoe rabbit or an ermine, but in the main it seemed that all life had fled the land. It was a condition not unknown to them, for in all their experience, at one time or another, they had traveled 1 year through a region teeming with game, where, a year or two or 3 years later, no game at all would be found. Gold they found on the bars, but not in paying quantities. Elijah, while on a hunt for moose 50 miles away, had panned the surface gravel of a large creek and found good colors. They harnessed their dogs, and with light outfits sledded to the place. Here, and possibly for the first time in the history of the Yukon, wood burning, in sinking a shaft, was tried. It was Daylight's initiative. After clearing away the moss and grass, a fire of dry spruce was built. 6 hours of burning thawed 8 inches of muck. Their picks drove full depth into it, and, when they had shoveled out, another fire was started. They worked early and late, excited over the success of the experiment. 6 feet of frozen muck brought them to gravel, likewise frozen. Here progress was slower. But they learned to handle their fires better, and were soon able to thaw 5 and 6 inches at a burning. Flour gold was in this gravel, and after 2 feet it gave away again to muck. At 17 feet they struck a thin streak of gravel, and in it coarse gold, test pans running as high as $6 and $8. Unfortunately, this streak of gravel was not more than an inch thick. Beneath it was more muck, tangled with the trunks of ancient trees, and containing fossil bones of forgotten monsters. But gold they had found, coarse gold, and what more likely than that the big deposit would be found on bedrock. Down to bedrock they would go, if it were 40 feet away. They divided into 2 shifts, working day and night, on 2 shafts, and the smoke of their burning rose continually. It was at this time that they ran short of beans, and that Elijah was dispatched to the main camp to bring up more grub. Elijah was one of the hard-bitten old-time travelers himself. The round trip was 800 miles, but he promised to be back on the third day, one day going light, 2 days returning heavy. Instead, he arrived on the night of the second day. They had just gone to bed when they heard him coming. What in hell's the matter now? Henry Finn demanded, as the empty sled came into the circle of firelight, and as he noted that Elijah's long, serious face was longer, and even more serious. Joe Hines threw wood on the fire, and the three men, wrapped in their robes, huddled up close to the warmth. Elijah's whiskered face was matted with ice, as were his eyebrows, so that, what of his fur garb, he looked like a New England caricature of Father Christmas. You recollect that big spruce that held up the corner of the catch next to the river? Elijah began. The disaster was quickly told. The big tree, with all the seeming of hardihood, promising to stand for centuries to come, had suffered from a hidden decay. In some way its rooted grip on the earth had weakened. The added burden of the catch, and the winter snow had been too much for it. The balance it had so long maintained with the forces of its environment had been overthrown. It had toppled and crashed to the ground, wrecking the catch, and, in turn, overthrowing the balance with environment that the four men and 11 dogs had been maintaining. Their supply of grub was gone. The wolverines had got into the wrecked catch, and what they had not eaten they had destroyed. They plummeted all the bacon, and prunes and sugar and dog food, Elijah reported, and gosh darn my buttons, if they didn't gnaw open the sacks, and scatter the flour and beans, and rice from Dan to Beersheba. I found empty sacks, where they dragged them a quarter of a mile away. Nobody spoke for a long minute. It was nothing less than a catastrophe, in the dead of an Arctic winter, and in a game abandoned land, to lose their grub. They were not panic-stricken, but they were busy looking the situation squarely in the face and considering. Joe Hines was the first to speak. We can pan the snow for the beans and rice. Though there want more than 8 or 10 pounds of rice left. And somebody will have to take a team and pull for 60 mile, Daylight said next. I'll go, said Finn. They considered a while longer. But how are we going to feed the other team and 3 men till he gets back? Hines demanded. Only one thing to it, was Elijah's contribution. We'll have to take the other team, Joe, and pull up the Stewart till you find some Indians. Then you come back with a load of meat. You'll get here long before Henry can make it from 60 mile, and while you're gone there'll only be Daylight and me to feed, and we'll feed good and small. And in the morning we all'll pull for the catch, and pan snow to find what grub we've got. Daylight lay back, as he spoke, and rolled in his robe to sleep, then added Colin better turn in for an early start. 2 of you can take the dogs down. Elijah and me'll skin out on both sides, and see if we all can scare up a moose on the way down. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.